Good afternoon. Thanks for coming to what I hope is very lively and useful discussion on a gorgeous Tuesday afternoon out there. We're glad you actually came down to the bowels of CSIS to join us here for two very influential and very provocative speakers. We've got David Rothkopf and Robert Shapiro, who I hope need no introduction, but whom I will introduce nonetheless. This, needless to say, is one of our series many, I hope, conversations that we're having around something we're calling the Smart Power Program. The Smart Power Project is something that was inaugurated last year, headed by Joe Nye and Rich Armitage, along with a panel of experts, basically looking at the fact that in the United States and that that there is a consensus, at least among elites in this country, that the United States' engagement with the world has perhaps not been as robust as it could be, and perhaps that we need to move towards more engagement and figure out how to do that a little bit better and smarter, and how to exercise U.S. power more smart, to lack a better phrase. That's in contrast, in many respects, with the theme that we're seeing play out in this presidential election among non-elites, among most members or many members of the public. That is that there is ambivalence, to say the least, about America's engagement with the world, economically and otherwise. And so this desire on the part of elites to draw the United States closer in with the rest of the world, to exercise more activities in multilateral institutions and the rest of it, may be at odds with what the public wants. And one of those the key issues is how the United States fits in to the whole issue of globalization and how the United States operates and how U.S. citizens and elites operate within this increasingly globalized or de facto globalized world. We have, as I said, two terrific folks to come and talk about that and other issues, and we hope this is styled as a we know this is going to be styled as a conversation, not between necessarily just me and them or them and they and each other, but between all of you and them. So hopefully we'll get to that. David Rothkopf, many of you will remember from his days in a previous administration, so he has plausible deniability about what's happened in the last 8 years or so. He is a very respected writer and distinguished speaker, frequently asked to comment on what's going on in the world, and does so with great aplomb. His book, available outside, if you'd like, is Superclass, which looks at sort of the rise of a very different kind of elite from beyond that within traditional four corners of states to sort of much broader constituencies. Also, another very distinguished former member of a previous administration, this time and a very very well known economist, Robert Shapiro, is the I think founder of Sonicon LLC, an advisor to not just multinationals but to governments around the world. Was the former Undersecretary for Economic Affairs in the Department of Commerce. I'm going to ask David Rothkopf to go first and maybe give 10 minutes or so, if he can, to sort of lay out some thoughts and then ask Rob to follow up.
Thanks. Well, it's a pleasure to be here. It's nice to see all of you here. Thanks for the invitation. Thank you, Carola, for the invitation. It's also nice to be up here with Rob, who we had lunch a few weeks ago right around the time this came up, and we're saying we ought to do this together because the themes dovetail in the book, and so in the two books, and so this is a great opportunity to do that. Needless to say, you know, I spent a year and a half writing a 400-page book, and so it's very easy to boil down into 8 minutes.
Take ten.
Well, in that case, I can cover it all. I'll just talk about a couple of key themes, and then maybe we can pick up on others. I'll start by telling you what Superclass is not. Superclass is not a book about the ultra-rich country clubs, Greenwich, Connecticut, or big jet planes, although I do talk a little bit about private jets. My agent calls that the pornography of the rich, and it's been a very popular category in the book business, and it's not about that. Superclass is the subtitle is The Global Power Elite and the World They Are Making. And for a group in Washington, that should resonate, because there was a book 50 years ago called The Power Elite by a guy named C. Wright Mills, which looked at the leadership structure in the United States and how the business and the military and the political elites in the United States interacted with one another. And having written a book a couple of years ago about how foreign policy is made in the United States called Running the World, which resulted in a book tour in which some place that I went, every place that I went, somebody would say, that's the trouble with you folks in Washington. You think you're running the world. And thus taught me the important lesson of not using irony in a title ever again. The goal that I had was to say, well, you know, who really is most influential in the world today? And if C. Wright Mills were writing that book today, how would it have been different? And I think the most fundamental way his book would have been different is that the elite would not have been a national elite. It would have been a global elite. And that over the course of the past 20 or 30 years, we've seen an emergence of our generation's elite. And it looks quite different from the elites of past generations. There have always been elites since the dawn of time. And another thing this book is not is an eat the rich book. It's not a book that assumes because somebody is in the elite they are necessarily evil. Although certainly there are some evil members in the elite. But rather, it is a look at this global elite and how they have emerged and how they're different from past groups. And it's not just that they operate on a global stage. If you looked at an international elite 30 years ago, that international elite would have been primarily public sector figures. The international or the global elite that I looked at in Superclass is primarily private sector figures. Another thing that is different is that military elites, which were important at the time of C. Wright Mills, and in fact 4 years later, General Eisenhower, President Eisenhower used in his farewell address the term military-industrial complex to talk about a concern that was on the minds of many Americans then, the military elites are in decline in this group. They are less influential because the cost of modern warfare has just grown too high, and it's difficult for countries to use that as a tool. The role of nation states relative to these groups has changed somewhat because as we have a growing roster of issues that are transnational, they fall beyond the reach of sovereign governments, whether it's trade or financial markets, as we've more recently seen, or the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, or transnational health issues, or immigration issues. The list is long, but very, very clearly, because we have only two kinds of international institutions in the world today, weak and dysfunctional, there is a void. And the void ends up very frequently being filled by informal clusters of the super empowered who are able, not through conspiracy, I just finished doing a radio show, in which they said, so you're a member of the world elite. Is it true that you have a plan to eliminate 80% of us through eugenics and make the rest of us your trained SEALs? And, of course, I responded that I would never use the term trained SEALs.
More irony.
Yeah, right.
More irony.
More irony. Probably also lost on this group. I do take a kind of dim view in the book of conspiracy theories, and also of the notion that Davos or the Trilateral Commission or Bilderberg or the Bohemian Grove or the fathers and sons meeting of Carlos Slim or China's Bo Ao Forum are somehow running the planet for us. Having been to some of those, I know that Davos is essentially a bloviation festival. Steve Case, when I was doing the book, said to me, he goes to Davos and he always has the impression that something interesting must be happening there, but it's happening someplace else. And, I certainly have had that impression for 6 or 7 years of going and come to the conclusion, if every year I think it's happening someplace else, maybe it's actually not happening at all. But one of the great powers of this group, if it doesn't have the power of conspiracy, is the power to help shape the agenda. And I think that's one of the two great powers of this group, the other being when individual members acting in their self-interest have aligned self-interest with everybody else, and you have groups of super-empowered individuals acting in parallel, they tend to get their way, especially when there aren't institutions representing the interests of the public. Given that I only have 8 minutes, and I finished that a couple minutes ago, I just want to say that the book explores how the emergence of this group challenges our conventional assumptions, not only about the role of states, but about the entire Westphalian system and about where counterbalances come to speak for the interests of the many. And it focuses, especially as an example of why they're so necessary, on the fact that in parallel to the rise of this group, we've seen the rise of historically high levels of inequality everywhere in the world, whether it's inequality between countries. 100 years ago, the richest nations were 9 times richer than the poorest. Today, they're over 100 times richer. Or within countries, where we now have a situation, even in the United States, where in Manhattan, the richest 10th were once 9 times as wealthy as the poorest 10th, and now they're 90 times as wealthy as the poorest 10th. Or among groups, where the 1,100 richest people in the world have a net worth that's roughly equivalent to twice that of the 2.5 billion poorest people in the world, that there is something seriously wrong in the system that is producing this, and where over the past 30 years in every country except India and China, middle classes have shrunk. Admittedly, absolute poverty has shrunk, the number of people in absolute poverty, admittedly, the bottom has risen. But if relative inequality grows, that's a formula for political instability. And that is worrisome. And whether you think that, you believe that the elite should be 6,000 people, as I defined it, using a definition of people who have influence of the lives of millions across borders on a regular basis, or whether you think it's 60,000 or 600,000, it's a tiny fraction of the planet, most of which is unelected, which have been advocating approaches for the past 30 years, which take different forms in different countries, but sort of have all moved in the trend of what I might call market fundamentalism. Leave it to the markets. Let markets take care of everything. Governments are inefficient and an impediment to these things. And that has led to a lot of inequality and potential fracture lines that we're going to have to deal with for a long time. This poses a central challenge. And that I believe that the great creative challenge of our generation and the next generation is going to be, how do you create effective governance on a global scale that can counteract the power of the few in a way that the legitimacy of the government or governance mechanism flows from the consent of the governed, as we believe is one of the sort of few irreducible organizing principles that society should have. And that's a creative problem that we can't shrug off, because globalization, despite the rhetoric of the current political campaign, is not something that we can opt out of. We can no more, having a decision to build a wall in the United States is, to me, the ultimate exercise in futility. And in fact, I think that wall should be redesignated as the monument to futility, to the notion of a 700-mile wall on a 3,000-mile border, which has the express purpose of keeping out not illegal immigrants but the future, seems to me to be a manifestation of the wrong kind of reaction. And it's time that we start having discussion about what the right kind of reaction is to a completely different global social structure and the inadequacy of all the institutions that we currently have in place to meet the challenges of that changed global social structure.
Terrific. David raised a lot of questions about the future, and we're happy to have the guy that can answer those questions. My hay fever neglected caused me to neglect to mention his book, which is also sitting outside, I think, as if not more prominently than David's, Future Cast, which
just shows you who's in the superclass and who isn't.
which I'll let him describe in greater detail, but again, starts to go down some of the and looks at a lot of the questions and raises some provocative answers to the questions that David set up.
Thank you. It's first of all, thank you for inviting me and putting together this forum. It's a real pleasure to be here, and always a pleasure to be with my very smart and very witty friend David Rothfeld. Future Cast posits that there are three large, deep structural shifts occurring, which will affect the paths of the world's major nations over the next 10 years. The first is the historic aging of nations, a phenomenon we've never seen before, even in a single nation, where the phenomenon of a very large generation succeeded by a very small generation. We see it now in virtually every country in the world outside the Middle East and sub-Saharan Africa. The second force is the change in the organization of geopolitics from a system organized around balances of power to an arrangement in which we have a sole superpower with no near peer, at least in the current period. And the third is economic globalization. These are all historically singular phenomena, and they all have global impact. There are many themes in this book, but one of the themes, the theme I want to talk about today, is the theme of inequality, because I'm sharing the stage with someone who has thought very deeply about these issues on a global scale. And we can see in both the demographic phenomenon and in globalization forces which are driving increasing inequalities. In the demographics, we can see the demographic shifts. It's very interesting because different nations are subject to these shifts in somewhat different ways. And it's producing a contributing to a surprising divergence in the economic paths and the level of wealth among the world's advanced nations, in particular between the United States as compared to the major countries of Europe and of Japan, has also contributed to a decrease in inequality among a certain set of developing nations who had large baby booms at a time when they invested enormously in education and infrastructure. We saw that in the East Asian Tigers. We've seen it in Ireland. And where those countries used, in effect, the demographic shift to help modernize themselves and make a leap forward. But the most interesting, certainly, is to us at this time, I think, is this issue of inequality among nations. And the tide of demographics is between the major countries of Europe and Japan and the United States. And the fundamental difference is the fact we haven't built that wall. And the United States' circumstance is fundamentally different. In Japan today, the labor force is contracting at a rate of 1% a year. The French labor force will begin to contract at a similar rate around 2012, and the German labor force around 2015. Meanwhile, their elderly populations are growing at a rate of around 3% a year. They have very large social welfare systems, both in healthcare and in pensions. Their pension provisions are a good 50% more generous than ours. We can already see it claiming resources that would otherwise go to investment in these countries. In fact, one of the interesting results of, for an economist at least, of this kind of demographic shift is the reminder that saving behavior is very age specific. It's people save primarily from their mid-30s to their mid-50s, then they begin to dissave. And consequently, as the relative cohort of a society in the mid-30s to mid-50s contracts, the saving rate falls. The saving rate's not the only reason, but in Japan, the saving rate over the last 15 years has fallen from 25% to 5%. Now, part of that is the rate of return on capital, but about half of that is driven simply by demographics. Same thing is occurring in Europe a couple of years behind. And if the rate of return of your businesses is not sufficient to attract a lot of foreign savings, as ours is, this contraction in the saving rate leads to a further contraction in the investment rate. Already, the average income in the United States is between 27% and 41% higher than in Japan, Britain, France, and Germany. It used to be between 12 and 18% higher. So we're seeing a real divergence in the economic paths of the major countries of Europe and Japan and the United States. Part of this is demographics. The other part of it is globalization. And I want to talk briefly about two aspects of globalization that drive this phenomenon. One is, and at a gross level, one of the reasons the U.S. economy overall, in terms of our productivity gains and in terms of our growth rates, has so significantly outpaced the major economies of Europe, not some of the smaller niche economies, have done a very good job, but the major economies, is that we are so much more globalized. 50% of our imports come from developing nations. 44% of our exports go to developing nations. 27% of our foreign direct investment is in developing nations. In France, Germany, and Britain, 20% of imports come from developing nations. That includes oil, as opposed to 50. 18% of their exports go to developing nations, as opposed to 44%. And 9% of their foreign direct investment is in the developing world, as opposed to 27% of ours. Europe, the large economies of Europe, trade and invest almost exclusively with themselves and the United States. And the result is that they have cut themselves off from the efficiencies of the global networks which globalization creates. And they have a much smaller presence in the most dynamic markets in the world and the fastest growing markets in the world. And that's another reason why the U.S. growth rate and productivity rate has diverged from that of Europe and Japan over the last 10 to 15 years. The second area of inequality that I want to discuss is really, to my mind, the most fundamental thing happening in the United States today. And that is globalization has had a very unexpected, a very unanticipated effect on two of the most fundamental dynamics in the U.S. economy, and reliable dynamics, and that is the enduring relationship between how fast the economy grows and how many jobs it creates, and how fast productivity increases and how much wages rise. These relationships are based on a free labor market. Nothing has changed in the U.S. labor market, and yet let's compare the previous 20 years with the last six. With the current expansion, which is the first expansion we've had in a world in which of the current era of globalization, because it's the first one that includes China as a large presence in the world economy. After all, in 1995,
China exported $65 billion worth of goods. Last year, she exported almost $800 billion. The phenomenon of China is about a decade old as a global economic force. Following the 1980s recession and the recession of the early 1990s, it took 18 months for the U.S. to return to its pre-recession job levels. This time it took 52 months. The Bush administration, with sound growth rates, talks very proudly of having created almost 6 million jobs. The Clinton expansion created 22 million jobs. In the 1990s, productivity rose at an average annual rate of 2.5% a year, and the median wage, which covers 75% of the workforce, rose at an average annual rate of 2.2% a year. The last 5 years, U.S. productivity has risen 3% a year, the best record since the 1960s, and the median wage has not moved at all. This is a very startling phenomenon for economists, that this traditional relationships between growth and job creation and productivity gains and wage increases has weakened very, very sharply and perhaps broken. We don't know. How do we explain it? Well, we can't explain it by changes in the labor market because the labor market hasn't changed inside the United States. What has changed, of course, is the global context. And the largest force in that change is the indirect impact of China. Not the direct impact, but the indirect impact. Now, remember that China has pursued a model for modernization that was not possible before globalization. It's unique to China. Before China, the United States, Europe, India, everyone used the model of import substitution. We put up protectionist walls to let our industries become strong enough, and then we went out into the world and competed. China did quite the opposite. China, following the terms of the WTO, tore down those walls and invited the advanced companies of the world to move their entire business organizations to China. And this is our 27% of FDI. This is a process only possible under globalization, not possible under the previous era of international trade. And the result has been this stupendous growth. Stupendous growth in exports. More than a third of China's GDP is exported today. And these exports have swamped the exports of other developing nations. They don't swamp our exports. They're either our companies, the Chinese operations of our companies, or producing things that we don't produce and haven't produced for a generation. The real competition for China is Taiwan and Malaysia and Egypt and Uruguay and India and Bangladesh. And in these countries, China's exports are swamping their markets. And other countries are trying to get out of the way of the Chinese export tsunami. And the basic way you get out of the way is you try to move up the value chain a little. So you're producing something they're not producing. And the result has been that China is driving modernization in a lot of other developing nations. As she does so, the nations that she affects in the first order begin to put more competitive pressure on economies that are a little more advanced than they are. And because China is such a huge presence in global exports, this is happening across scores of sectors, and the effects are being felt through scores of nations as capital and expertise in nation after nation moves a little up the value chain. And what happens when it reaches the United States? When, for example, capital and expertise in Mexico moves out of the production of some of goods that are being produced in Brazil and moves into oil services, for example, competing more directly with the United States. We can't transfer it anywhere. So here and in other advanced economies, it's experienced as simply an intensification of competition. And the result of that is what economists call a reduction in pricing leverage. It becomes harder to raise your prices. This is why inflation has been so low for the last 15 years, despite the enormous expansion in the global capital pool, is a systemic increase in the intensity of competition, reducing the capacity of businesses to raise their prices. Now, what happens when businesses facing this kind of competition have to absorb very large increases in fixed costs? In particular, when their healthcare costs go up 100%, as they have in the last 7 years, because we have a government that's ignored this issue, and their energy costs go up 100%, again for the same reason. What happens is they cut other costs, and the costs they're cutting are jobs and wages. And they are breaking the traditional connection between how fast the economy grows and how many jobs we create and how much productivity rises and how much wages increase. And let me tell you, this is political dynamite. If we do not address this issue, it's a structural issue that's not going away because globalization's not going away. And if we don't address this issue, we will find ourselves in 10 years, ironically, because we're the country best positioned for globalization among the advanced world, we will find ourselves with a kind of politics, as David has said, that none of us wants and none of us will feel very comfortable with. Thank you.
Right. Now I feel good.
Yeah.
David, you described the sort of global institutions as either weak or dysfunctional, and described also that the emergence of this global elite that sees beyond borders and the rest of it and doesn't rely on traditional organs of state power or whatever else it may be. And Rob, you very correctly, I'll quibble with you on some of the China issues, and I'm not sure I'd blame the current administration on all the administration. Well, you blame the current government on all this and that, but you're right, certainly, that there has been some serious faults with respect to healthcare and energy policy. But you rightly point out that there is political dynamite out there with respect to inequality and the fact that the have-nots are not getting theirs, and the American dream seems to be going the way of all things. Given these two separate dynamics, that the elites don't want to depend on the traditional organs of statecraft and state power and want to build these global institutions that otherwise are weak or dysfunctional, and yet there is this huge mass of people that is not anxious to see either the elites get their share or to see beyond the limits of their ability to control things. What happens? Are the elites able to sort of look beyond this and see self-interest and say, we need to either help those that the disaffected get theirs? What happens?
Well, I mean, several things happen. One, if we'd gone anywhere in the world, 30 years ago and said, what's the political dynamic in your country? You would say it was between socialism and capitalism or communism and capitalism. And now, increasingly, in a lot of countries, you ask what it is, and it's between internationalism and nationalism. Mm-hmm. And so there is a political dividing line issue that is rising in countries around the world about how you react to globalization, with one group sort of taking what I consider to have been sort of the thrust of the Clinton administration, which is, how do we make globalization work for us? And another group saying, the way we make globalization work for us is opting out, slowing it down, and so forth. So that's one manifestation of this. I think the other point to make, though, is that this global elite that has emerged, which is primarily a private sector group, has obligations. It's typical when you have a discussion of this sort to characterize them in terms of personal views or values. But most of these people are operating in a values-free zone. They're legally obligated to advance the interests of their shareholders. That's what they're supposed to do, and if you own shares in their company, that's what you would want them to do. And if you are acting in that way, then you are not sitting there and saying, well, what's in the public interest in the United States, or what's the public interest in the United States versus the public interest in China. You're saying, what's in our interest? And one of the big things that's happened is that companies have grown so large that it's completely unprecedented. When C. Wright Mills wrote The Power Elite, the defense budget of the United States, which was smaller in real dollar terms than it is today, was bigger than the combined annual sales of all the largest companies in the United States. Today, the combined annual sales of Exxon and Walmart is 50% higher than a defense budget that in real dollar terms is bigger than any we've had since 1944. The 250 largest companies in the world have sales that are the equivalent of a third of global GDP. And the biggest of them are bigger than many countries in terms of the economic resources at their disposal. I mean, sales and GDP are not anywhere near the same thing, but if you look at a central power being the power of asset allocation, the power of asset allocation that the 50 biggest financial institutions have $48.5 trillion under management, which by one measure is a third of all the assets that exist. So they are mandated to operate in the self-interest of the company and the shareholders. They operate on a global plane, and they are going to be a big countervailing force to national interests. And so, you know, you take those things together, and what you can see is that we're in for a period of real tension between the issues that are of concern to us, whether it's inequality or how do you get yourself competitive, and forces that want to push those issues to the sidelines and say, how do we advance our core interest, which is maximizing profitability? And last year, Exxon's profits were equal to the GDP of Bahrain and Yemen added up. Mm-hmm. So, you know, to give you a sense of, you know, the scale of the operations.
Let me say, I'm kind of optimistic on these issues. And the reason I am is that I think if we understand what's driving these dynamics, we can address them. There's absolutely no reason why we can't create a radically more energy efficient economy. Lots of other nations have. And reduce the impact of increasing energy costs. There is certainly no reason why we can't reconfigure a lot of the arrangements of our healthcare system in order to slow the rate of increasing costs, recognizing that the biggest difference between the United States and the major European countries, take France for example, the French healthcare system is really very similar to the American system in terms of the way you interact with hospitals and doctors. There's a large private insurance sector, covers large co-payments mainly. It's a public-private system, and we would recognize and probably, and for many Americans, would welcome the actual interaction between doctors and patients and hospitals and individuals. They spend 11 to 12% of GDP on healthcare, and we spend 16%, and there's really only one fundamental difference, and look, I'm a market economist, but the fact is the difference is price controls. And when you look at our demographics and the fact that globalization is driving enormous increases in healthcare costs by expanding the market for healthcare technologies and consequently increasing R&D in them, and that these technologies are enormously expensive. You look at biologics, for example, drugs, which are moving to the center of the pharmaceutical industry. There are, I think, 70 to 80 small molecule pharmaceuticals, that's a regular pill, in second and third stage clinical trials and about 300 biologics. And biologics are on average 45 times as expensive as small molecule pills. So, you know, this is not a good picture financially. But if we understand the nature of it, and if we understand that energy and healthcare are no longer simply security issues and social policy issues, but fundamental jobs and wage issues, then I think we can address them. And the last thing we can address is, there is another dimension to this inequality, and that's technology and the skills to operate in it. And this is particularly true in the United States, because one of the reasons that the United States is so successful in globalization is that we have embraced the role of advanced economies in globalization, which is to develop the new technologies, products, processes, ways of distributing, marketing, financing goods and services, ways of organizing a business, running a workplace. That is all the intangibles. And the reason we have is that the idea-based economy has moved from metaphor to concrete reality in the United States. Federal Reserve data show that since 1995, for the first time ever in economic records, U.S. corporations invested more in intangibles than they did in tangible assets. That's in patents and copyrights and databases and training and ways of organizing. And indeed, in 1984, the book value of the 150 largest U.S. corporations, that is what you could sell their physical assets for on the open market, was equal to 75% of their market value. Today, it's equal to 36% of their market value. Two-thirds of the value of large U.S. corporations now lie in intangibles. Those workers who operate effectively in a work environment which is suffused with the technologies which organize and use those intangible assets, i.e. information technologies, have been doing fine. It's the 75% who don't. We can do this is, again, something that is easily within our grasp.
Can I jump in with something here?
Yeah.
Because, I mean, enough optimism.
Thank you.
I mean, seriously, it's getting Pollyanna-ish here for a second. clearly these things are within our grasp. Everything that you describe makes good sense, and one would hope we would get there. Clearly, anybody who's listened to the political debate over the past several months realizes we're not actually talking about these things in a serious way. Okay. But, you know, it may happen. You know, it could happen. You know, if you take them and you break them down, you know, coming up with an efficient, energy policy, we are a long way from that. We just passed an energy bill where we set a goal of 36 billion barrels of ethanol, two-thirds of which was supposed to be a kind of ethanol that we're not sure how to produce, one-third of which is a kind of ethanol that we know is inefficient. And at the same time, we reduce subsidies for solar and wind. Why? Not because that's rational, but because the way law gets made in Washington is from the special interest scrum, where people pull and push and tug, and you end up with things like our prescription drug bill, you know, thousands of pages of chaotic and inconsistent legislation. But the central issue for the planet in terms of energy is how do you use coal in a clean way? Because if every alternative energy policy in the world comes through, it's 12% of the market for the next several years, which means that 88% of its traditional forms of energy, and of that 88%, most of that's going to be the cheaper forms because the Chinas of this world need that. And we're nowhere near getting any kind of an agreement on how to deal with that, nor are we anywhere near coming up with the technologies for how to deal with that. So there are impediments, just as there are impediments with regard to healthcare and the other issues you discussed. At the same time, we have $9-10 trillion worth of debt in a country that has no savings rate. And if you want to be an advanced nation and competitive, you have to do that by investing in infrastructure and education and the kind of things that we need, but we can't afford.
Well, I don't agree we can't afford it. I think we easily can afford it. I think the challenges we face today are less than the challenges we faced at any number of times in the past. And we have usually managed to respond effectively to them. Look, great societies sometimes don't respond effectively to the challenges, and they begin to decline. And that could very well happen in the United States. If we can't respond to these challenges, that's absolutely a possibility. I also think it's a we have a political system which, particularly in the Congress, is weighted down by special interests pursuing the return to shareholders that you describe so well. We sometimes have the capacity to overcome them. I was there, I remember, in the 86 tax bill it happened, and for a while anyway, and then it kind of backtracked. It takes political leadership, of course it does, particularly in a large, diverse society like ours. And I don't see a lot of that, but we don't agree entirely on some of the political figures out there today. But I think it's possible. Look, I think it's a... this kind of progress comes from, frankly, first, intense conversation among elites about how important it really is to what they care about, which is their own interests and also their values. That's what we're doing today. It's exactly what's going on today. And then it expands. And sometimes leaders grasp it and create some change. It won't be an optimal change. And look, some of this can't be undone. The demographics can't be undone. We are going to spend more on health care, and our taxes are going to go up for it. And there's no way to avoid that. You know, we are in the midst of a demographic anomaly, and we can't wish it away. And so we're going to absorb some of those costs. That's right. Other thing, but we can make those costs a little less, or maybe significantly less, or not. And on climate change and coal, I mean, look, I agree with you, but I think we have a much longer period of time to address it. It's a climate, we need to begin to address it today. That is, I don't see clean coal as the answer. I think we have to get rid of coal, but it's a, or sharply reduce its use in energy. Over the next 30 years. And if we do so, we can contain the adverse effects of climate change. But we need to start to do that within the next couple of years. And the U.S. has to lead, or China will never go along. And if China doesn't go along, no matter what we do, it won't matter.
Well, let's get the audience in on some of this. We've got someone up front. If you can identify yourself and then... we've got, I think, mics coming around the room, so we've got just up here, and then we'll go.
I'm Richard Gardner, Columbia University. This excellent discussion has gotten around to the key issue of domestic political constraints on smart power and on political leadership. So I'm going to be very provocative. Evaluate the three candidates for president in terms of how they address the globalization issue, and specifically, since the two of you have served in Democratic administrations, and I'm a Democrat, some of you might know, was it really necessary for the two aspiring Democratic candidates to say, to turn their back on the great tradition of the Democratic Party, Cordell Hull, Roosevelt, as recently as Clinton, and say, we have to renegotiate NAFTA, take a time out from trade agreements, not sure we want to complete the WTO round, attach conditions on trade, on environment and labor rights, which are not negotiable probably? Or could they have said, yes, let's continue this forward movement in liberalization, but let's make it work for the average American by doing some of the things you've hinted at, a more equitable tax policy, health care, trade adjustment assistance? They could have taken that route, and they didn't. Why?
Well, I mean, first of all, that was a rhetorical question, right?
Yes.
I'm so glad I let you go first.
I mean, clearly, it was not necessary for them. Clearly, the reason they're doing it is pandering. The reason you pander is because you're not confident in your ability to win without pandering. And, you know, you've got a very divided Democratic Party that on a regular basis fails to do the arithmetic and plays to what it calls its base, which won't go anywhere else, rather than playing to the center, which has always been the ticket to actually getting into power ultimately when it gets into power. The base, the Democratic Party, is not terribly enlightened when it comes to these issues. The trade policy offered by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama is appalling. This stance on renegotiating NAFTA violates, you know, common sense, it violates tradition, it violates what's in our long-term interests. The fact that, you know, how many rooms have we all sat in where people say, oh, don't worry about it. You know, once they get into power, they'll change that. I think miscalculates tremendously. Something has fundamentally changed in the Democratic Party. And I think where they're going to start is that a new administration will come in, if it's a Democratic administration, and where the forces that are afraid of globalization are going to respond is by going after China, particularly, with a new sort of cocktail of protectionist measures focused on things like currency value, product safety, sovereign wealth funds, and a whole host of other kinds of things. And what we're going to do is we're going to stick our thumb in the eye of the one country that we absolutely need in order to achieve global energy policy, control of weapons of mass destruction, the global economy, and so forth. So what worries me is what I would characterize as the domino effect of faulty trade thinking that is going to lead us into a place where we can't achieve our broader diplomatic and national security goals. Now, by the way, this is not me saying that China doesn't need to change its policies. But there are ways to achieve that that are more likely to enable us to also achieve our other goals. And, that hasn't left me a chance to speak about the broader policies with regard to globalization of these candidates. Certainly, I do not feel that the solution to all of America's problems is to futilely promise to withdraw from a region we will not withdraw from the next 30 or 40 years, and to repudiate the use of effective smart power in favor of the Oprah Winfrey approach of let's talk to everybody.
Let me be the optimist, because I am more optimistic on this. Look, why did they do it? You have to ask their political consultants. Was obviously not an economic decision. It was a political decision. And a political decision typical of contests which are very close. And so there is, you know, a escalation in the appeals to smaller and smaller groups. That's utterly predictable. Let me say the base moves both parties in directions which are not in the interests of the United States. The base of the Republican Party has moved John McCain to a position that the only thing that's wrong with the U.S. economy is that corporate tax rates are too high. That's a kind of decided ignoring of virtually all the evidence. I think all of them know better. So this really goes to the way we conduct our presidential elections. But look, I think the reason for these appeals is also the underlying reality that I've tried to describe, that globalization indirectly and in an unexpected way, not through direct competition with China, but in this unexpected way, is changing the economic landscape and prospects for large numbers of people. And on top of that, we have a recession, which incidentally is also fundamentally driven by dynamics of globalization through capital markets. And the result is that people are angry, and politicians respond to anger by saying, I'm going to get what you're angry at. Look, I was an advisor to President Clinton, and in particular on NAFTA before the 1992 election, as you know very personally. And, I considered it a great political act on his part, his support for NAFTA. The great act with respect to globalization and trade was the Uruguay round and the WTO and the Chinese accession, and that has not yet been put on the table in this campaign. So that's the optimistic take on this.
I'm going to go here and here.
Thank you very much. My name is Paolo von Schirach, Schirach Report. One of the issues that are systemic that I don't think you really have addressed except tangentially is, especially as far as the future of the United States is concerned, is education. You mentioned energy. You mentioned healthcare costs related to the aging problem. Just to mention one recent example, Bill Gates testified in front of the Science and Technology Committee of the House a few weeks ago saying, I am not confident that the United States, if it continues with this type of education policy, will retain its position as the main focus of innovation worldwide. Given the implications that you have indicated, knowledge economy, intangible assets, et cetera, being the dominant forces in the driving the world economy, if we have undermined, for better or worse, the education system as the machine that produces the new generation of knowledge economy leaders, where does this take us? And this is not something, again, aside from trade policies and other matters or gasoline tax prices that are, you know, hot in Indiana today, this is hardly mentioned at all in serious terms during the campaign.
I agree with you. I think we'll get a lot more of it in the general election, frankly, campaign than we've gotten in the primaries. It's an issue on which it's kind of the default position of Democrats to support more funding, at least for education. I think we need a lot more than just more funding for education. But this is a responsibility of the next administration to take more seriously than I think has been taken in recent years. My own focus, however, is less on the education system, because that's a subject of kind of robust debate, and there are lots of interest groups that act into it and tend to drive up spending in many ways, though also tend to slow down reform.
You're not referring to the American Federation of Teachers.
I'm not referring to anybody. But rather the absence of serious opportunities for upgrading the skills of the current workforce. Yes, we have to ensure that every child has not only an education that prepares her or him for a work environment suffused with new technologies that we can't even imagine today. But we have 50% of the current workforce that essentially can't operate a computer. And in 10 years, there won't be a job in America that doesn't involve information technologies. A construction worker will hold a handheld computer, will tell him what rivets to do next and the pace of his or her work. And, you know, a truck driver will be operating off of on-cab computers. We have no provision for that. This is one of my pet proposals, so you're going to hear it. I've been proposing this for some time. You know, we could provide grants to our community college systems, cost $125 million a year, could cost $250 million a year. That is chump change. To have them keep all their computer labs open 3 evenings a week and on the weekends for any American adult to walk in and get free training. No reason why we can't do it. It's cheap. It's the sunk investment is there. It just requires it requires the political system, it requires the elites that David understands so well to see this as a priority, to see the ability of half of the American workforce to operate effectively in businesses, even if it's not, doesn't have an immediate effect on the rate of return to shareholders.
Isn't that effectively, though, I don't want to call it trade adjustment assistance of a kind, but globalization adjustment assistance or something?
Yeah, it is globalization adjustment. I like that. Yeah.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, I mean, you know, with all of these issues, let's accept first fact that you have a corrupt system that in which oxygen is money. The money is the oxygen in the system. And which is driven and will be for the foreseeable future, unless we change that, by various special interests, including some on the corporate side and some on the non-corporate side. And on the side you're talking about, when you go and look at education reform, the impediment to most of the things you want to do about changing the way you compensate teachers, allowing people to fire teachers, allowing people to, you know, and so the impediment's the union. It's not the company, the corporate world. I think most of the people in the sort of superclass and sort of elites generally recognize the importance of this. I don't know that I would focus on exactly the same places that Rob has highlighted. This is certainly not a reason not to, but lifelong education is going to be the mode. You know, training people for the beginning of their lives when they reinvent their careers five times throughout their lives is an outmoded system. It needs to change. We need to move towards more effective lifelong learning. Secondly, we view curriculums in a certain way. So, you know, again, you have the AFT saying, we don't want national curriculums. We want to leave more autonomy here. But you've got a national network for distributing information cheaply, which would allow people to create, using this technology, cheap, rich curricula that could be chosen. You could have 10 choices for your high school calculus curriculum. You could have 50 choices for it, each created cheaply and available broadly across the United States, and be transforming in the context of the system. But because of the dogma associated with something like national curricula, you can't get there. Infrastructure, education are two of the critical building blocks of competitiveness in the United States, and they're not being addressed in the kind of zero-based, let's be creative about where we can go here way that they need to be.
Go here.
Thank you. Carl Dahlman from Georgetown University. I've enjoyed the discussion very much so far, and I want to go back to the globalization. In terms of the global GDP, between 1990 and now, the share of traded products has gone up from 38% in 1990 to 61%. This is part of what you're discussing. It's a gigantic avalanche. It's putting tremendous adjustment pressure on the whole world. And basically, you have a lot of new entrants, China, India, former Soviet republics, coming into the market, quadrupling of the global labor force between 1980 and now. So this is a tremendous pressure. And we see that the U.S., even the U.S., is beginning to feel the impact, as you pointed out. So is there a risk that there can be a reaction to globalization, a closing down like happened at the beginning of last century? And what can be done to sort of put that off in terms of the kind of smart policies that are necessary, especially here in the U.S. where you have a country that's spending beyond its means, but we don't save enough, the trade deficit, the fiscal deficit, now the international community might not be financing, not being the ATM machine, very difficult. So that's at the domestic level. At the international level, we also see it and pointed out that it's the multinationals who are benefiting the most from globalization, and very properly they're serving the stakeholders' interests, but they're now working at odds with even their home country governments. And so that puts a new tension. So at the global level, you don't have any institutions to rebalance like you have at the national level with distributed policies. And since the institutions are dysfunctional, how can we get the superclass to begin to focus on some of these issues? So it's a domestic question and a global question.
Well, look, first of all, you use a term which I think we should just take out of our vocabulary when referring to these companies, which is the idea of home country. Both Rob and I had the great privilege of working for the United States Department of Commerce, an institution which any sensible government restructuring would eliminate. But the reality is you regularly get a call saying, we've got to do this with an American company. American companies need this. There aren't American companies. You know, and let's just stop thinking that way. There are companies, you know, most major companies operate everywhere. And they use national governments to the extent that they can to help them advance, you know, their goals. The problem is that regular people just don't have a voice in that context. One of the things that I hear a lot when I'm out talking about this, people say, well, you know, not in more enlightened groups. Well, we were pretty globalized 100 years ago and we stopped being. There was a reaction to it. But if you take the net line over the course of the past century, we didn't stop. There was a setback and then we continued along with globalization. And I think that that's, you know, this is an epochal transition. And I think you can expect setbacks, whether it's caused by this recession or, you know, economic upset in China or the spread of nationalism or populism among the Chavezes and the Correas and the Ahmadinejads and the Putins of this world. And there will be places where there will be setbacks. But the ultimate decider is whether average citizens are stakeholders in globalization, whether they benefit from globalization. And most of the reforms we promoted during the 90s, the Washington Consensus reforms, had the unintended effect of benefiting elites who, when we privatized, were the ones able to buy the assets. When they liberalized, were then the ones taking advantage of the liberalizations to grow their companies. When they competed for global capital, began to have interests that were at the odds with the workers in their own countries who they would prefer keep their wages down. In many, many places in the world, particularly among the half of the people who are economically and politically disenfranchised, they're not seeing the benefits in a tangible way. And right now the deal we're offering them is roughly akin to the deal that was offered in the 12th century, which is work in the muck, and my friend the priest, who I just appointed, tells me that you'll do fine after you die. And now what we're saying to people is work in the muck and your family will do fine in five generations after you die. It's a lousy deal. And until the deal changes, you're not going to have the kind of, you know, comfort level with the system that isn't going to produce backlash. So we really need to say, how do we make globalization work for the average person? What's in it for them? And who is going to advance their interests?
I agree with all of that. I
was hoping for the glass half full here, but anyway.
The other thing we need to be prepared for, and we should accept and expect it. Look, globalization is—it has very positive aspects, and it has clear negative aspects. It's having negative aspects on issues of equality. It's having negative aspects on prospects of upper mobility. It is producing asset bubbles around the world and instability in financial markets. All of that arises out of the dynamics of globalization. We're going to learn just how severe the distortions are. Look, China's model, which is the model of globalization for modernization, is the fundamental globalization model, is causing enormous distortions in China. It's involved the unwinding of their healthcare and pension systems and a literally pay-or-die system in healthcare in order to feed modernization. It's produced a manufacturing sector in the absence of the basic governance institutions to regulate the health and safety of products because it didn't happen gradually the way it happened in other societies. Massive problems in the environment. The Chinese model of globalization is simply not going to proceed smoothly for the next 30 years. It's going to hit a lot of rocks. And it's going to adjust, and the world is going to adjust, hopefully. And so, I mean, one of the things that, you know, those of us who are, you know, have believe that greater openness overall increases the benefits, social benefits for the entire set. Also have to remind ourselves that that's a very large and abstract principle, and inside it are a lot of incredibly messy details that we're going to have to address. And if we don't address it, then those distortions, and if China doesn't address those distortions, China's going to find herself with enormous social problems, social unrest that will create an entirely new path for China and not one its elites want. And the same thing is true in the advanced countries. Let's accept that this is not going to be a kind of easy glide, but in fact a large and bumpy challenge. The world's not flat. The world is full of surprises, and half of them are unpleasant.
Well, let me add something to this, because I see as we get closer to the end, people periodically get up and leave, and you who have stayed a little longer need to benefit from that. And so I want to throw out a couple of things that we haven't touched upon here, two in particular. One, we've talked about the revolution of globalization, which is enormous. The revolution that doesn't get talked about and is only sort of tangentially associated with what you raised, but is really, really important to keep in mind, is the securitization revolution that's taking place in global financial markets. And the total transformation of the wealth and financial structure of the planet to the point that most of the critical transactions taking place are unregulated and either misunderstood by the few elites who have some understanding of them or not understood at all by almost everybody, including the people who are responsible for them. $30 to $40 trillion in derivatives where you don't know who the counterparties are. Yeah. A system where countries don't create the vehicles in which wealth is carried about, paper money. Investment banks do, stripping them into lots of different components. And so you talk about all that money going from tangible to intangible assets. I'll tell you this. We have no idea how much wealth there is in the world, what's real and what's fake, and where the risk is. And this is going to cause gigantic upsets in the global economy. The second thing that's related to that is that we've gone through 25 years of what you could call Reagan-Thatcherism, or you could call it Volcker-Greenspanism, or you could call it Friedman-Friedmanism, Milton and Tom. But it's essentially market-marketism. Leave it to the markets. Let markets take care of it. John Podesta called it market fundamentalism. This is what happened in financial markets. Left it to the markets, essentially unregulated, or underregulated, certainly, where the country with the lowest regulatory regime sort of sets the rules of the game. And it's produced this perverse, ingrown, complex, misunderstood system full of risks, which are going to come back and bite us, much as the mortgage-backed security one did, and growing inequality. Because only a few can benefit at the maximum level in this kind of a system. And that era is at an end. We are about to enter an era in which there is a regulatory resurgence, in which by necessity, because healthcare and education and energy policy and everything you need to do to be competitive going forward requires a more active role of government. And so I think we're at the end of a 25 or 30 year period, and we're about to enter into a period in which newly creative thinking about the role of government, the nature of regulation on the national stage and on the global stage is going to become the sine qua non of national success. And we can both give examples of, Sweden, the ultimate Euro-socialist, flush it down the toilet, it's over country of, 20 years ago, has grown more rapidly than the United States over the course of the past several years, has announced it's going off oil by the year 2020, leads the world in a number of these areas. Why? Because they believe in a role of government. Europe leads in alternative energy because they believe in a role of government. things are changing that are associated with this that are all linked, and we haven't had a chance to talk about some of them. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to throw them.
No, I absolutely agree with that, and it will probably be led in by finance, where globalization is most advanced, and in healthcare, where the demand for access is most absolute.
I would say, and in energy, but yeah.
Sometimes the markets, you know, yield a demand for more government, more regulation. It's wonderful how that works. Right here.
Stanley Kober with the Cato Institute. 100 years ago, the world was also experiencing one of the great eras of globalization. Steam replaced sail, the expansion of the railroad, telegraph, and so on. It was brought to a crashing end in 1914 by war. So far, war has not been mentioned. The United States is engaged in some serious wars. How does war affect your calculations?
The kind of war that ended the last period of, I guess we can call it globalization. I think it's different in kind from what we're experiencing today as an economic factor, but certainly the vast expansion in international trade of the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century is not going to happen in the next generation, at least, because we are in an era of a sole superpower with no near peer. We're not going to have great nation-to-nation wars involving the large nations of the world. So that kind of war, I don't think, is possible. But if you mean political instability and its potential impact, I think that's significant and could be very great in China, in the Middle East in particular. We haven't mentioned terrorism. And in most cases, I think the impact of terrorism is vastly exaggerated as both an economic and political fact. 9/11 had no effect on the U.S. economy except a slight distributional effect. The quarter following it was stronger than any quarter 2 years in either direction, in both consumption and investment. Didn't disturb the U.S. expansion. But there is a kind of terrorism that can. And I think there are certain game changers out there for globalization, for the current geopolitical system, and I think probably nuclear terrorism is a game changer. But those are, I think, thankfully, low probability.
One of the things that I explore in the book is that in every area you look, power has been concentrated. And it's certainly true in the defense area. There are 20 or 30 or 40 countries that have weapons of mass destruction, and there are only 9 or 10 that have nuclear weapons. There's only 3 that have air forces of over 1,000 airplanes, and there's only 1 country that has the ability to really wage a global war, wage a war in space. That country spends half of all the money spent in the world on defense. It and its allies spend 85% of all the money spent on defense. The top 10 defense contractors in the world are within the NATO alliance. The likelihood of a major global war in the next generation is quite low. The likelihood of lots of small regional conflicts with an asymmetric component is somewhat higher. These are costly. I think that in terms of, if you're talking about American competitiveness, this is an interesting issue because we have reordered the entire national security structure of the United States around the idea that terrorism is our principal threat, which is clearly not the case. And we have moved to a footing where we're spending more on defense today based on that premise than we have at any time since the Second World War. And, I was thinking in terms of the earlier question about the campaign, we all need to have what is called in technical high-level Washington meetings like this, finely-tuned bullshit detectors. And in the context of, this kind of debate, there are a couple of things that, if somebody says this, then they're beginning to talk about the truth. You know, giving somebody a $30 rebate on a gasoline, that's nonsense. The truth is we need to spend more on gasoline, so we move to other forms. And when somebody starts moving in that direction, that's fine. You know, tax cuts of this sort and that sort, all incremental, it's nonsense. The country's got $9 trillion in debt. Unless we raise taxes, we are not actually going to solve an important competitiveness problem, and we're going to remain dependent on a few foreign borrowers for a long time. And the third one is, and you know, I'm sorry to say this, it's heresy, particularly for somebody you know who's a you know avowed centrist like me, but the defense budget's got to go down. Okay, we can't afford to do all the things that we're doing unless we actually and that we need to do to be competitive unless we actually spend less on defense. And one of the ways you do that is that you acknowledge that the military threats that we face today and over the near term are less than any that we faced in the entire preceding three generations. And that while we need to be prepared, we need to put it in the appropriate context and recognize the enormous strengths that we have in order to deal with the most likely major threats. I do think the nuclear issue is a game changer in the sense that it will change our view of civil liberties, it will change our view of borders, it will not change the global economy in any major, substantial way. But it may, just as global warming may, it may actually mobilize us into creating the kind of international institutions that have enforcement mechanisms as well as a good heart that may actually get something done.
The optimist.
Yeah, right. I'm optimistic about nuclear terror.
Let me just say one thing, and that is, I tried to figure this issue out in my book. I agree entirely with David with respect to the defense budget. It will be very hard to do because the strong impulse, the deep impulse of a sole superpower with no near peer is to see everything in the world as within its interest. And that is precisely how we have conducted ourselves. It's precisely how the quadrennial defense reviews now see the world. And not only with respect to the fact that we now have military commands covering every part of the world where we didn't before. We added the Africa Command and, interestingly enough, the North American Command, which is us. But in addition, that the defense intellectuals and the people who will make defense, who will advise whoever is president next, now see every issue as a potential national security issue. So climate change is a national security issue because it can destabilize countries and make them more havens for terrorists. And financial instability is a national security issue. This is part of the logic of a sole superpower with no near peer. And we have to understand it if we're going to, frankly, contain it.
Well, it's also, it's a uniquely American disease. I mean, you know, read Paul Kennedy or, you know, I mean, try and figure out what it is that could be our undoing. And the notion that somehow we as a country in the current environment need to spend, depending on how you count, between 12 and 20 times what our nearest next adversary is spending in order to be secure, even though we are in an effective global alliance and they're not, is nuts. And so the extent to which we're not, but you can't have that discussion in polite conversation, in polite society. Fortunately, we're in a group like, you know, this one. And we could be more candid.
We've got literally about one more minute. I'm going to ask a female perspective here and then ask you to respond.
The group that is most underrepresented in the superclass is women. There's 94% male. It is 6% women. And if anybody thinks the world wouldn't be better off once it addressed that inequality, they're not paying attention.
Well,
there's no political statement there.
That's also true.
I'm Sheila Ronis with the Vision Working Group of the Project on National Security Reform, and I'd like to ask the two gentlemen to give us their vision of a successful United States.
30 seconds.
You go first.
A successful United States is peaceful and prosperous.
I agree with that.
Well, that was pretty good. Thank you all very, very much. Please join me in a round of applause for a very provocative discussion.